Okay, so hi everyone, thanks for joining this panel discussion, and also thank you to all the postdocs that agreed to come here to give you a bit of insight and perspective on what does it mean to get a postdoc interview. And in fact, I think they're going to tell you that it can mean different things, so it doesn't have to be always the same kind of thing, so they're going to share their different experiences. So first I have to say that obviously, all of them are very successful because they got a postdoc at PI, so you get the best of the best in the room. And so so we have Jesse here, who is a postdoc in cosmology. Then Luna, you're also in cosmology.
Just for a little bit of variety, yeah.
Okay. And Barbara, you're for quantum information. Quantum gravity. I mean, she's giving talks in all groups, so she big overlap. And then we will have a second group later, and I don't know if everyone is already here. So Enrico is here, and you're postdoc in QFT string. And then, hi, so Lucien, okay. And you're postdoc in, are you strong gravity or?
Strong gravity.
Okay, so thanks. So, and then we'll have two other postdoc training.
Takato and Larry.
Okay, and quantum matter and also QFT string. So yeah, you will have a different perspective. So really, I think there will be some question asked by Bindia, first to start the discussion, but really think about what is your most pressing question that you have, what you want to know. And of course, I'm sure they are in the building, so if you have more questions, I'm sure you can reach out later. If you think about something else later, I think it's really important to get ready. And I have already seen some of their comments that they have amazing advice that I would have loved to know when I was applying to postdoc, so really take that as a as a good perspective to and opportunity to ask anything you want. Thanks again, and I let you. I let you start. I'm just going to sit in the back, learning myself.
I'm more comfortable here than you're talking directly to the students, I guess. The way it has been planned is we can start with a brief experience, individual experience of you applying to various postdocs, like number of postdoc positions and where you applied to, and also maybe if you have done a previous postdoc, a useful tip which you think is the most useful for them. And then once we have this general introduction, help them formulate their questions from you, but I could start with one question, and then they can have And it's 40 minutes before the next session starts, so we are kind of on time, I guess. And so I can start with Jesse, because I think you are the most experienced here in terms of being applied twice. And if you could share like some strategies, especially the fact that it's very useful to have a personalized vision, because this has been mentioned by everyone.
Yeah, so I guess, just as a quick overview of my experience, I did my PhD in the US. This is my second postdoc. I did my first one at Stanford, so I have an N equals two level of sampling on the experience of what this is like. First time, I think both times I applied to around like 30-ish postdoctoral positions. The first time I got like a couple interviews in the form of like talk invitations. And ultimately I think I got two offers, though both times, like once I got an offer, I kind of went down my list and withdrew from a lot of applications that I knew I wouldn't choose over the offer I already had. So in terms of like evaluating statistics of like offers versus number of applications, it can be kind of hard to evaluate. And then the second time I applied, I think I applied to a similar number of jobs. Initially, in that point, I had been thinking that I was going to apply to a mix of postdoc and faculty jobs after my first postdoc. But then I was applying for jobs in fall of 2020, and so I just was like, decided to focus just on postdoc positions to like limit the amount of stress I was under. And that time I think I had like two like talk invitation interviews and then like several sort of one-on-one call interviews for postdoc positions with like individual professors looking for somebody to work in their group. And you know, I got the Perimeter offer, so great. And I think when we were asked for advice or tips in the sheet, the couple of things that I noted, or one is, it's important to make sure your email address is findable online. So like doing something like setting up a simple like professional website, which can just be like an online posting of your CV. GitHub makes it really easy to set this up. I'm happy to share tips and or Git repositories. Just in the sense if somebody's interested in learning more about what you do or like inviting you to give a talk, if they have to spend a really long time trying to search around and find how to actually contact you, there's more of a chance that that like, gets lost in a tab and then get forgotten, or just you want to make it as easy as possible for people to get in touch with you. And then the other thing that I noted is like probably a year or so before you're planning on applying, though I don't know, timelines are flexible and fields will vary, is to like think about places that you might want to work or where you are interested in making more connections. Talk to your advisor about that and see if you can visit different departments, or if you're in an area for a conference or something, if there's a research group that you're interested in, like seeing if you can extend your trip by a few days and just like contact somebody and ask if you can visit the department. You can, usually I would sort of frame it as like, oh, if you have a group meeting, I'd love to sit in. And usually that means you get invited to give a talk. And a thing that I learned being a seminar organizer at my previous postdoc position is a large number of the people that are invited speakers, either they or their advisor or collaborator has like emailed and asked them like, hey, can you invite me to give a talk? So like that's something that I think as a PhD student was not apparent to me, that is aware. And like even if you don't get invited to give a talk when you visit a department, getting practice just chatting with different people, setting up meetings can be good for making connections, learning about different physics, and just like getting to know people. And a very good practice for that, if you're like a little nervous about it, is meet with seminar speakers when they visit Perimeter. We have a lot of interesting speakers coming through, and just getting a little bit of like low pressure practice at like 20-minute to half hour chats with people about like sort of the intersection between their work and yours can be really nice.
So, yeah, maybe you can also share some experiences.
Yeah, so, hey everyone, my name is Luna. So, I'm originally from Serbia, but I did my undergraduate and my PhD in the US on the East Coast. And then I applied to like something like 40 places. I was applying in the fall of 2021, so it wasn't quite the fall of 2020, but it wasn't a much more chipper experience. So all talks that I gave or something like that, like Jesse said, I invited myself, or I like talked to friends that I had in other departments and was like, put me on the seminar list, but they were all virtual. So that was kind of nice because I didn't have to travel a lot, which is exhausting, but on the other hand, you don't quite get a feel for the place doing things virtually, so some sort of pros and cons. I think now if I were to redo it, I would probably apply to fewer places. I think I sort of started off saying like, I'll only apply to the places where I really want to go, specifically places that I really want to live. And then I just kind of like let my insecurity snowball and was like, but what if I don't get anything? Surely by applying to this, you know, thing in Ohio where I never want to live or go is useful to me. So, you know, if you can sort of like, if you're like me and you sort of like get a little bit of the panic, if you can keep the panic down and actually say like, okay, but this is this something that I want or do I just want to get anything, that can be helpful, I think. In terms of interviews, so I got a few interviews and really the main two offers. So one was from Perimeter and one was from a 50/50 teaching research postdoc in Colombia. That I ultimately declined because it doesn't pay nearly enough to live in New York City. I also sort of like retracted myself from a few things because I was still technically on some short lists, but they couldn't tell me when they would let me know. And this was already sort of like late February, so but at this point in the game, it's kind of, by this point, like a lot of people were sort of pressuring me to give them answers, and I didn't feel good like letting Perimeter hang on, for instance. And so I just said, you know what, whatever, just I'll say no, and thank you for the consideration. But yeah, so in terms of interviews, the two main ones I want to highlight, so I got an interview here, which I super didn't expect to get because who knows about the rumor mill? Great, don't look up the words rumor mill. So the rumor mill is a place on the internet you go to drive yourself insane because it contains half true information about who got offers from what position. And so according to the rumor mill, PI offers were done. So I had already scratched it off my list. And then I got an email to interview for Perimeter, in which I misspelled Neil's name. But I got the interview, which was I gave a talk virtually again because 2021, and also my US visa was expiring, which is a hell of its own making. And then I like chatted to Neil for 30 minutes after. And I thought that whole process went so well that I got off the call and then messaged my advisor, well, I won't be getting an offer from Perimeter, and moved on with my life. So just so you know, it's a stressful time and you might not be seeing the clearest picture of yourself. The other type of interview that you might encounter, I encountered from Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena. They have like a theory fellowship thing. I'd already given like a mini seminar over the internet, but the way they do interviews is like a panel style interview. So they're sort of like Perimeter in the sense that they're a research institute. They're not like a department. And so they have a limited number of permanent faculty, a lot more postdoc stuff like that. And so it was like something like four people maybe interviewing me. And I could kind of figure out who they would be just by Googling and seeing like who's permanent on the website. And so they asked me some questions sort of about my research and how I fit at Carnegie and why I'd be excited to live there and, you know, do stuff there and stuff like that. Really, the advice that I got is that the most important thing is for me to ask them questions. So if you have something like this or you have a visit or something like that, I think it conveys a level of interest and involvement to ask questions about the place, because that signals that it's something that you're seriously considering and interested in, because they don't want to go through the process again either. You know, the process is, I think, annoying on both sides and everybody just wants it to be done. So I think that's my piece of advice, because I wasn't sure that I would encounter that type of interview. I thought it was only seminars. So it was a little bit different, but it was pretty good. I think something you said made me think of this, but I don't know exactly what you said, but when you're sort of faced with, visiting and trying to find intersection in what you do and what the people at the place that you're visiting do. So I think like, as a theorist, you're doing something, and that can be super interesting and like mathematically viable and elegant and stuff like that, but a lot of the times while you're doing it, there's no guarantee that that's like actually how the universe functions, right? A lot of the time you're waiting on some observation or experiment or something like that. But so long as there are like techniques or ideas or literature that you're using that can be of interest to other people on the committee, that is something that you can like bond over and talk about, and that is where they can see an intersection between their work and yours, and that sort of makes them want to work with you. So definitely, especially if you're in places where there's sort of like a limited number of permanent people that you're talking to, looking for those intersections and highlighting them, I think, is always a good idea.
Yeah. Barbara, I see that you were a student at MPI. So I think you resonate the most with these students here.
Yeah.
And you can share more experiences with your application process.
I was a PhD student here. Maybe my experience is a little bit different because most of my PhD was during the pandemic. So for us, there weren't many opportunities to network, the things that they suggested. So yeah, but when it was time to apply for my process, I was actually quite uncertain that I would manage to get any jobs. I don't have as much experience as that, but I did do two interviews. So I gave basically you apply, they're interested in your application, and they ask you to give a short talk, maybe like half an hour. For me, both of them were over Zoom. And then they ask you questions, discuss with you, and so on. So I did two of those. You can ask me about that. And one of the things I mentioned in the Google Doc is, so when I was going into my last year, I was told that it's really important to give good talks, because if you give a good talk, you can even get a job out of it, and if you give a bad talk, then it's really bad. Remember that. So I kind of didn't believe in that, but I gave it a go anyway. So I decided to give good talks, and actually it worked out because I got a few job offers from talks at conferences. So I really suggest that you really practice your talks and learn how to give really good talks. And I hear that that's important, not just at this level of applying for postdocs, but even later when you're applying for faculty jobs, that can make a big difference.
Thank you. So I think I can start with my questions briefly, and then we can ask students to have their questions. One thing, Luna, which you said that talking to panelists and all, do we already know the names of the panelists, or is there a way of knowing who the panelists is so that we can go and find out their research interest and try to formulate a connection between our work and theirs?
So in my case, that was like in the theory side of Carnegie observatories, there were like four people, so it was quite easy to deduce that those were the panelists. And one of the permanent research scientists there was a PhD at my institution, like she graduated just as I came in. So nepotism is a great way to get things, unfortunately. So if you know someone at the institute, like ask for the academic gossip, because sometimes your friends, even if they're like undergrads or grads or something, can sort of like ask around and find out. But sometimes it's just like a process of elimination. And you know, you can only prepare so much, but having maybe a general idea, at least of the people that you know you have intersections with, that's something that's nice to mention. Because again, that shows that you're also invested in this place. It's not like your fifth interview of the week and you're like, whatever, I don't care, I have an XYZ lined up or something like that. Because if they're putting in effort, they wanted to get to something as well, because otherwise they're not interested.
And Jessica, if you could recommend some strategies of contacting, because I think that's the most important part of the application process, where you try to contact the institute for a interview or maybe just giving a research presentation. So how, some tips?
Yeah, so as I've run into, like I've approached this like in slightly different ways, like the sort of easiest thing, or at least easiest from like the way I get anxious about social interactions, was like basically asking my PhD advisor for help. Like when in my like second to last year of my PhD advisor was really big on like prompting me to do this or helping me like try and identify some places to visit. And like things that can open up avenues is like you have a collaborator on a paper that you've worked on, or like if somebody has worked on a project that you've like referenced a lot or something, like getting ideas of people to reach out to on that, and having either a project or sort of like science topic or something that you want to talk about is sort of like a focal point. So like you're like, oh, I've read your work on this. I'm interested in visiting. I'm going to be in town because of this conference. Am I going to stick around an extra day or two? Could I? I'd say like extending existing trips to like spend some time in a department is probably the easiest thing from like a funding point of view. For like actually traveling and going to a place that I was collaborating with a couple people at University of Pennsylvania during the sort of tail end of my PhD, which at a different university, at University of Michigan. And I'm not exactly sure how the funding worked behind the scenes, but like basically we arranged for me to spend 2 weeks there, and it was something like my PhD advisor covered the travel and UPenn covered the housing or something along these lines. If there's some funding I could apply to through my university. So things that if you can like piggyback on the travel that you're already covering with like conference travel grants or something, or if like a perimeter has some like partnerships with other institutions, I'm not really sure what the status is. But the funding is the reason why it's probably easiest to go through your advisor or to tack things onto other visits. And then I'm in a somewhat unique or maybe slightly different situation than many people in the room in that I do a lot of like galaxy survey science, which means I have a large collaboration and like see people at collaboration meetings twice a year, so you end up building connections that way. So that would probably apply more to people in cosmology or strong gravity. Otherwise, you know, meeting people at conferences or people that you've met with when they visited your room or to give talks, I think. I don't know, like the funding part is the tricky part for travel.
And Barbara, so you said you have two kind of interviews, like a talk and a panel-like interview. So can you give more tips how each one of is different and what kind of preparation each one requires?
Well, I would say I gave these two, I had these two interviews where I gave a talk to some kind of a panel, I guess, around five people who were asking me questions. So that looks like a 30-minute talk followed by a lot of questions by people who are in Zoom call. Another type of interview talk is that I gave a talk here at BI, and I gave a talk at MIT, and I have to say, I thought they were just talks. I didn't know that they were also job talks. So I was told later, oh yeah, this is how they do it. They give you a chance to give a talk and then they evaluate you. So that's something to be aware of. In your application here, all talks are job talks. Yeah, I actually wanted to say something that seems important. So even if you're going to a conference and giving a talk and you're kind of trying to get your work out there, maybe meet people, get a job from that and so on, often people who are at the conference or even at the department where you're giving a talk, they don't show up for the talk. That's a big problem if you're trying to get your work up there, trying to talk to people. So one of the things that you have to do, you have to pre-network before your talk. You have to talk to people and tell them, oh, I'm giving this talk later. Maybe you should come, you'll be interested. Because then that really increases the chance. I've seen that happen. I think that's important to
answer. I think we can have questions from the students. Yes, specific questions from the panelists.
When you guys were applying for postdocs, did you have any indication of how competitive your application was?
I remember applying as a PhD student. I was like, I hope I get something, but I don't know if I'd be surprised if I don't get anything. So I didn't feel like I had a strong gauge, and like I had a couple publications, but not like a huge number. And I kind of like shifted to different areas of cosmology throughout my PhD. It worked out, but I did not have a high level of confidence before I applied that they would.
I started browsing industry jobs by the time I got through their offer. I fully had this vision of me like spending 2 months depression napping on my mom's couch in the room. So I didn't feel super confident, hence the 40 applications.
Yes, same.
I mean, not exactly the same, but similar. Okay.
So we should kind of have questions to get into the interview today. Was it more related to actual work or to interview work? You mean during the panel interview?
Yes.
Yeah, so it was a little bit of sort of like explain your current work. And, you know, we'd all read my research statement, so I think it was more like, can you give an elevator pitch of your research, right? Because it's easy to explain, or it's relatively easy to explain something in a lot of words. It's really hard to explain it in a few words. But there was also sort of an element of like, where do you want to go with this? Is there sort of like a wider, you know, is there a broader research question that you hope this your work sort of feeds into? Like, where do you see it fitting into the subfield at large? And specifically, where do you see it fitting into what's already being done and the resources available at this place? So for me, I'm a computationalist, like I do a lot of simulations and stuff like that. So it was a big pro to talk about the fact that I'd already like looked at what their computing resources were like and had a general idea that they could support the kind of code that I'm running for like a reasonable time or something like that. Does that answer your question?
Maybe just to add, like, sort of, we've talked about like the talks that you may or may not be told are job talks beforehand, panels, and then like the other kind of interview that I've seen are like often for like fairly junior faculty starting up their research group, like one-on-one call tops. And those were much more just like conversations. So I've done a couple of those more in my second round of applications than my first. And those, like, I don't know, I spent some time like looking at people's like abstracts beforehand, but it was much more of a like chatting as if I had met someone, like, it was over Zoom, but like more like chatting if you meet somebody at like a conference, coffee break or something.
One more thing that we didn't mention that I think we would be remiss not to mention is the importance of what I like to call shaking the postdoc tree, which is that the moment that you get your first offer, you look at all the other people that offers that are still outstanding, like you haven't heard back that you'd be interested in them, and you send them an email like, hi, I just got this lovely offer from the Perimeter Institute, what's up? Because that's how I got the Columbia offer, because I emailed them and I was like, hey, just wondering if you know when you'll have results, because they have this other offer with the ticking time clock, whatever. And the, you know, who I assume is the admin assistant responded like, yeah, we're not getting around to it yet, you know, good luck with that, whatever. And then like half an hour later, presumably somebody looked at my application and went, so can you interview this Friday? So it is like, one of the ways that people want you is because other people want you, and that they're thinking, oh, what am I missing? So use FOMO. The moment you get one offer, you can use that to leverage other offers sometimes.
Yeah, and it's all like, even if you already, that plus, you know, just if something's lagging for a bit, like following up for more information is always reasonable. Like one of these one-on-one calls I had was for a group that I would have been really interested in working with. And then once I had the offer here, I followed up. It was like, you know, there would have been a bit of a decision point between like fellowship at an institution with lots of resources and versus being a postdoc in a fairly new research group, but with a lot more like direct collaboration probably. But it, like in that one, it turned out that they just were waiting to see if funding came through and basically told me like, all right, I don't think it's gonna happen, but don't wait on us.
That's exactly what happened to me with Carnegie. Basically, they said that, you know, like you're first on the wait list, but we're waiting to see if any funding comes through. Like if we get Hubble funding, Hubble is the big astronomy national fellowship in the US. So once, for instance, a big fellowship is out, a bunch of things reshuffle because they might have already accepted someone, but that someone now has funding from an external source. So now they have funding to like pay you. So being aware of maybe if they're times like that in your field, it might mean that, you know, things get reshuffled, and yeah, being a little bit annoying never hurts.
Politely annoying.
Yeah, and this happens sometimes that you get an offer and then the funding goes through. So that's also, I mean, I was disappointed that it just happens.
So you did apply, like, as a Perimeter PhD student, you did apply to other institutes as well.
You mean when I was applying for
yes.
Oh yeah, I applied to about 20
places. It's made a choice to stay here. Right? Do you think any part of your application was helpful in getting a position at Perimeter since you were already a PhD student here?
Yeah, I don't know. That was, I don't know what happened. So I was told that there's a rule that they don't make their own PhD students. There's probably still some kind of rule in place. And I talked to some of the faculty and they were against it. And then in my application, I tried to argue for myself. Like one paragraph, I tried to argue that I do different enough things that I can work with different people at Perimeter, so it's not like I will always be working with the same person. So and then in the end, they accepted the application. So I don't know what exactly was the decision.
Somebody today told me that you did a very good job of advocating for yourself, and that really impressed the community.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing, is that there are some rules, but you can change the rules sometimes.
Strong application. So maybe since I think part of the interview process is giving a presentation, that's like standard for it. Is there a format? Or you think something useful to include in that format?
I think, as Barbara said, like preparing far enough ahead of time to like practice is very important, and particularly practice to people that haven't worked with you on the projects you're talking about. Because like
having somebody who doesn't know the full background of what you're doing make sure it makes sense can be really valuable. I mean, yeah, when you get, if you get a talk invitation, you'll gauge, like, is this a 20-minute talk? Is this a 15-minute talk? Try to make sure you don't go over time. Like, sometimes, some places people don't mind, or sometimes the questions might be very interactive, like they often are at Perimeter. And so if you go over with that, it's, like, fine. But while some people don't mind a talk running, you know, over time, some people will find that annoying. So try and keep to time. I'd say, I mean, this should probably happen in any like seminar talk you give, but maybe compared to a talk where you're just trying to spread the word about a particular paper, making some time at the end for like some like future facing, like, where does this go next? And like making sure that in addition to talking about the specifics of whatever project, like you want to make sure you tie it into like big picture of like what are the questions in the field that this relates to. I mean, this would hold for any advice for giving any talk, but for a job talk, sort of showing you have that big picture awareness and like idea of where things are going next becomes even more important.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been on the other side, but my understanding of it is that like at one point there will be a bunch of people in a room with a bunch of papers in front of them, and they'll have to, you know, like read the applications, but then also argue and advocate for or against the applications. And so ideally what you want to be is more than a name on a page. You want that name to be like connected to a face or a voice or an idea or a manner or something like that. Like you want them to see you as more than the paper, because presumably if you're reading like 200 of these papers, you get, you know, you go a little cuckoo or something like that. So
I think like papers, maybe piece of paper.
Yeah, piece of application. Yeah, sorry, application materials, yeah, like, or PDFs or whatever they're staring at, right? Like you ideally want to be more than words. And so I think a good, you know, what you really want, or at least what I tried to aim for with the presentation, is to sort of convey my excitement for the field and where I think it's going, where I can sort of see intersections with the place that I am at, or maybe where I can even see like opportunities for collaboration or, you know, like mentoring students or something like that, depending on what the group setup is, if that's, you know, a thing. Because I think that I can come across more like alive and as an individual in person than just if you're reading like a piece of paper, no matter how much effort I put into that piece of paper. Because it's hard to advocate for an abstract name you see on a page or on a screen or something like that. It's easier to advocate for like a name that you can tie to a person, if that makes sense. So that's always my goal.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, if you want to
answer. No, I agree. I heard this also, that they basically, they have, in some places, they have debates between each other. They choose their favorite gun and then they discuss like which ones they should actually accept them. For that, they have to be able to kind of defend you in that discussion. That's if they know you.
Yeah.
I've heard in a previous like panel that on your application, kind of like outreach or like mentoring things aren't really valued that much on most like application. So you mentioned like you're having like an interview with someone, like discussing ways that you could help with like ongoing outreach at the institution or whatever, like, do people appreciate in that, like, setting, maybe your application, as I've heard, but, like, when you're talking with people, they like to see that you've looked into those?
Yeah, so I always put those things down because I don't know how to not put them down. I think that the myth of a researcher that does research and nothing else is crap. So I, you know, I have been warned about sort of being too, not wishy-washy, but being sort of like too, hitting too hard on the soft skills or whatever the hell that means in applications. But so what the balance I try to strike is really like, you know, make them invite you for the science and then make them stay for like the, you know, not just the science, but also the outreach and stuff like that. So I certainly mention it because if nothing else, it's something that I've spent a lot of my time on. And so I think that that's just worth mentioning because, you know, I spent a lot of time not just teaching, but learning how to teach, and not just doing EDI, but like learning how to do EDI and stuff like that. And so I want to account for that time because, you know, damn it, that was a lot of effort. I think you reconcile it with yourself, how important that is to you, or how, if that's how you see yourself. But to me, if that's something that's going to be a turnoff to an institution, then that's not an institution where I want to come.
I'd echo that.
Like, you do really want to make sure that, like, when you're talking or interviewing, you want to put the, like, forefront the science and make sure it's clear that you have expertise. And, but, like, yeah, I think it's part of, like, painting a picture of, like, what you'll be like to have as a colleague. But, yeah, I'm not seeing behind the scenes on postdoc panels, but my impression is it's probably more of, like, a tiebreaker than something that will move you up a ranking or whatever.
Yeah, I do this weird thing with doing data science and hieroglyphic inscriptions as sort of like a little side project in my PhD. And everybody told me basically like, that's nice, don't say it too loud, people won't take you seriously. But again, because I don't know how to take advice, I included that even a little bit. It's certainly on my website and stuff like that. It's something that I think is quite interesting and I'm proud of, but it's not like the majority of my work. You know, I really foreground my, you know, board physics group, but then I also bring that in. And, you know, today I learned, which maybe I shouldn't have, but I'm glad that I did, that like that was one of the person who was advocating for me when I got hired at Perimeter was really excited about that. Because presumably, you know, like 50, you know, I don't know, a large percentage of the people that apply for postdocs at Perimeter are like really excellent scientists doing really great work that, you know, fits well into the thing. But you need that extra edge, and sometimes it'll work against you and sometimes it'll work for you. And so that's one case where apparently it worked for me, which I absolutely had no idea that it did until truly today. But that's the risk of it.
I would like to jump in because this is a common perspective that if you're a good science communicator, you're not a good researcher. That's usually seen, so people try to amplify like that. But my take would be to see what the institution's aims and agendas are. If media is one of the important factors in that history, I think you should highlight those things as well because they appreciate the, as you said, a bit of edge to your application, it seems. But yeah, you should align your application according to what the expectations of the institution are. Because if they're really involved into media, then you should that in the application, but if they don't care about it, then you
don't mention it. And if you don't care about it, don't put it in. Like, go somewhere or
don't pick it.
Yeah. Write an application towards the kind of like job that you want to do. You know, like how you would like to actually spend your time. And obviously, if you want to spend your time, I don't know, becoming the best chef in the world, maybe don't do a physics postdoc. But you know what I like. Like, have it come from what you want to do and what your sincere interests are and what you actually think is, like, a good way to spend your time. Because I got very stressed when I was first writing the first draft of my postdoc statement, being like, oh my god, what projects do I even propose? Like, what is this? You know, suddenly I have to be independent. And I sort of, like, sat down and thought about it and ultimately wrote something where I was like, hell yeah, this is exciting to me. I would love to spend 3 years working on these projects. And so if you can get yourself to that state, then you can convey that state to the panel or whatever, the faculty, and that will always shine through.
I've always put, like, my CV has always had an outreach section and like a department service, or like a service section, which includes like being a referee or running a working group in a galaxy survey, but also things like EDI committee stuff.
Yeah, I'm the other man. Then I'm putting this on my CV because I forgot. So I just recently figured out this is something I should put on my CV.
I found it very helpful when writing my CV to talk to my friends because sometimes they remember things that I did that I don't. So yeah.
Did you have a plan in place, or do you have an idea of what you would have done had you not gotten any offers?
So my advisor gave me the offer that he claims he gives all of his students, which is that he would support me for a year of a postdoc to do one more application, basically, and the funding to pay me for like 1 year of being a project for me or whatever. I extremely didn't want to do that because I was incredibly burnt out and sick of my shared reality, especially within COVID. So my vision truly was sort of like, say screw it, move back to Serbia, speak for 2 months and then figure it out. Apply to some industry jobs because that was good.
I mean, the fact that academic jobs and industry jobs have very different timelines feels like a bit of like a grace. Like, I have not applied to industry jobs, but I did do, like, when I guess both times, but more so when I was getting ready to apply for my second postdoc, I made a point to do a couple, like, informational interviews. So, like, I talked to somebody who does, like, data science at, like, a political consultancy. I talked to somebody who, like, I talked to a few people who had either gone into, like, software. I think I talked to somebody who in science communication. Just trying to get a, like, gist of, like, what else could my career look like? Because I'm like, I don't want to apply for another postdoc just because that's the next thing to do. I ended up deciding to. But, like, for timeline, you know, for you're applying for postdocs, like, the fall before when you'd be starting. Whereas I think if you're working in the industry or even trying to apply to, like, a like data science boot camp or something, there's a much quicker turnover there. So, like, if you don't get something or the thing you get, you realize, like, I don't feel enthusiastic enough to move to this place or do this thing, like, you still have, you know, you'll know that by, like, February or March, right? Like, that's when most sort of decisions get, like, solidified. And if you're wrapping up in the spring or the fall, like, I don't know, I've heard of people applying for, like, data science jobs where the turnaround is on the order of, like, a couple weeks. Like, they want you to start within a month or something. I've not actually gone through this myself, but, like, it's a, you're not applying half a year ahead of time for those industry jobs.
Yeah, for me, the pressure was the visa, because I was in the U.S. on a student visa, so I had to have something to do, or I had to GTFO. But I decided that I would rather GTFO than do something despite it not being what I wanted to do, because at that point I was just so burnt out and so done with feeling stuck.
Did you have any backup?
Yeah, I applied for a position at OneQubit, so it would have been in the end some postdoc at OneQubit, still research. I also, I panicked and applied to McKinsey. I mean, it's just the feeling that you go through, like, oh, I'm not getting any responses, this is not going to go through, I better find a different job.
Yep. There's just a question online. Someone's asking, like, how much did your PhD advisors help you with the process? Or if they weren't very helpful, like, did you do things on your own?
Mine was very helpful. As I said, he was very good about, like, prompting me to try and plan some visits, gave some comments on a research statement, and, like, when I was trying to figure out, like, do I withdraw from this, or how do I balance these things? Like, because it feels like a very opaque process, especially the first time you do it. And so, like, it was like, is this talk invitation a job interview? I think my first year, I did an interview, got an offer from somewhere that I never interviewed, and then, like, through back channels, the first interview, like, asked my advisor if I still might be interested, because, like, once a place gives an offer, it's like there's some cost to them, because you might, like, if you don't make a decision, basically the later they get the offer out, the less of a chance they have to recruit the person they want. And so there was the sort of, like, back channel, like, if we made her an offer, would she be seriously considering it? I think another place at some point, like, asked me this more directly, which I think is probably better. But, I don't know, yeah. And just a lot of advice asking, I think.
Yeah, I'd
say
pretty similar. Yeah.
And I will note, the first time when I applied, when I was deciding between two postdoc offers that were pretty different, I was having trouble deciding. And so in addition to talking to my advisor, I talked to, like, several different professors that, like, I had interacted with in my department, and, like, realized that I got slightly different advice, and everyone's advice was, like, do something similar to what I did. Doing a little bit of sampling and asking for advice can be helpful as well.
It's just a question, but, like, how confident do you feel about working in your career and, like, meeting a permanent position? Like, are you sort of confident that it would work out?
To get a permanent position?
Yeah.
I'm confident in precisely nothing.
I feel like eventually down the line, probably, you know, to the unfortunate extent that names matter, like I said, nepotism is good, you know, I have names like Yale and PI behind me, so that's pretty good. But it's always, you know, it's a statistics thing, right? So it's small number statistics. So even with, and a lot of it is beyond your control, and it's even beyond your kin. So you do your best with the application. You can have everybody in the world, you know, read it and give comments and you polish the hell out of it, but you don't know what's happening behind the scenes. You don't know if the person that's advocating for you rejected some other faculty member's favorite, and so now they're going to reject you based on spite. You don't know what's happening. And so I think, you know, given enough tries and enough luck, sure, but I think it's always good to be aware that just luck plays a role. I think the bigger question is, getting a permanent position, sure. Getting a permanent position where I want it and stuff like that, again, that's statistics.
And that evolves over time as well.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
As well.
I was the hardest question.
Sorry.
How much did you take over your research students from places to places?
Barely at all. Like, I had a couple different versions for different numbers of page limits, but like I would always change the cover letter and like, but, and there would be some tweaks, like if the place I was going, again, I work in like a lot of galaxy survey science, and if the place was like a member institution in one survey but not another, I would like adjust the framing of being like, my work on the dark energy survey is preparation for this survey that you work on, or I will continue working on, you know, like things like what will I have data access to, but that was very much a like changing the first sentence in a section, but mostly I think a lot of the page limits are three pages, but then there's one place that wanted two. Basically, I had the version that I like polished a lot, and then I had a version where I had like figured out how to cut a page out of it. And I think the first time I applied for jobs, the job that I got was the one that I had haphazardly cut a page out of the research statement to get it to fit. But
my first one was the Papalardo, which notoriously wants two pages. So once I was able to fit it into two pages, three pages seemed like a breeze. I have like a paragraph towards the end that talks about fit with the institution that I somewhat tailored, and then, you know, changed the mention of whatever fellowship at whatever place. Like at one point, I literally had a version with XXX and YYY where it like, you know, command search XXX and put an institution in YYY and put in fellowship name or whatever. That being said, that's a little bit dangerous because it just applied to the University of Toronto with a cover letter tailored to Monsters University. So I have a chance to get that job. But, you know, beware.
Yeah, I was going to say that's something that I'm always a little bit paranoid about with tailoring, in that once you've applied to your like 28th position and you've looked at your research statement 28 times, like I no longer know if the grammar is sentences anymore.
Oh yes, it stops being English. You're looking at it and it's like floating in front of your eyes.
But at the same vein, I'm trying to, on each of my applications, at least name faculty that I'd like to work with. Is that something you guys do?
Yeah, I named like faculty or initiatives or something, or, you know, again, because I'm a computationalist, if it's like, oh, you know, I know that you have this computer or whatever, you know, like I know that I'm a reasonable fit in the sense that I can work with this person, or like, you know, that you have this whatever facility that can support my research needs or something like that. So I didn't try to do that with a reason, especially if it's somebody that I talk to. So if it's somebody that you talk to, you want to like make sure their name is on, you want it to reach their eyes, because again, they look at it and they see, ah, the person I met, or the person that gave the nice talk, or whatever. They don't see, well, this is a piece of paper with a name that I've never heard before, or vaguely heard before, something like that.
Yeah, I tend to do that in cover letters rather than research statement.
Yeah, I did both, I guess. That being said, I don't think I've ever figured out how to write a good cover letter, so maybe it just is a mess.
I got an example cover letter from my first postdoc advisor and made a very similar version for myself.
Today I got the comment that my cover letter reads like LinkedIn, which is the most eviscerating thing I've ever heard.
Yes, so thank you. And if anyone has questions, still have the Google survey form. So if you want to specifically ask questions, just let me know. And I hope you won't mind if they have questions that I transfer to you. But I hope they can always get to you directly as well. Or, yeah. All right, thank you so much. And thanks a lot.
Good luck, everyone.
So our next discussion is more designed for the international applicants, not only concentrated in US, Canada, but people who have applied for other institutes as well, outside North America. So I would request Enrico, Marvin, and Christiana. Your insights to the applications, including your previous postdoc positions or number of places you applied to, and any useful tip which you think would be most useful, and that could help them formulate their question. But before they ask their question, I have one question which I think would be of common interest to everyone, and I can ask each one of you if you have any discussion on your own. So I can start with you, and if you can share your insights, your application process, and
anything. Yeah. So I did my master's PhD in Argentina. So maybe it's a bit different from people here in the sense that we're kind of far away from the rest of the community, and it's hard to travel to other places. And we don't have any money. So and it was COVID, so it was a bit hard, but so I did my master's PhD there. But I have the good luck of working with a lot of people. So I worked with people here, the professor that was here at EI, and also people in the US. So that sort of allowed me to, you know, like insert myself in the international community. So I think that was key, and I think it should be easier for you in the sense, because you know, for Canada, US, you basically have a chance to travel to Europe. So I applied so this is my first postdoc. I applied 2021, and to like 10 places or so, which is a very small number, but one of the one of my collaborators was basically offered me this postdoc that position that he had, so I sort of had like a backup plan, so that's, you know, just sheer luck. So that's not an advice. I mean, the advice would be to work with, if you can, with different groups and different people. I think that's very, very useful. And so I applied to like 10 places, got 5 interviews and 3 offers. One of them was this AI offer, and also a number from CETA, so I did like a joint thing. Yeah,
that's my experience.
And how about you? So,
Enrico
and Christian,
so
you could share some tips and your experience.
Yeah, so, to introduce my application experience, this happened during the fall of 2019, just before when we are discovering COVID, but it was not really a thing, right? So, like, on the previous way. So, in a sense, I'm doing a long postdoc, but it didn't start like that. So, that's why I applied so early, but I'm still in my first postdoc, in fact. Because I probably will have to elaborate about this later. I got an extension, or actually, my contract was upgraded to senior postdoc last fall. So it passed from 3 years to 5 years, but still. So I practice had to apply only once. And yes, I did my PhD in Europe, in Hamburg, and I was in a rather good situation about the possibility of having international collaborations, because of course it's the best. Germany, Hamburg are hubs. And so I had a bunch of contacts, of international contacts, but I have to say they were almost exclusively in Europe. And I belong to a community, one foot and strings here in PI, but more specifically I was working in the disability and string theory community, which is strongly European centered. And so inside the community, this community, I had collaborations and I had well-established collaboration functions, papers, and so on, during my PhD outside of the work, besides the work of my PhD advisor. Therefore, I had a bunch of different directions in which to attack in order to convince somebody to give me a position. And yes, so the applications, similar to the experience of other people, included a range of 25, 30 applications, maybe more, but the less are less serious. Like, you just keep clicking on websites like academic job, changing a phrase in a cover letter, things like this, but not so serious. Yeah, I have to say that most of these applications are totally useless, so I agree with one of the advices of the former session, that one should concentrate on a smaller number without shooting in the crowd. And my experience is that the three interview offers I got were strongly connected to my work, almost directly the result of my collaborations. So it was not, I didn't have to try to send myself to new people at the moment of the application. This happens like almost on every advance. It was an outcome.
So I agree, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. So you have to be slow, be patient, choose your institutes very wisely, find a place. As if you apply to many places, I think you're just increasing your workload of applying it. That might be a bad thing.
Larry,
can you explain your share your experiences as an international applicant?
I did my PhD in States, University of Maryland, and I wasn't able to travel to conferences or any other events for the first 4 or 5 years of my PhD. Initially, it was because I was just a beginning grad student, and I didn't have anything to present at conferences. And then there were 2 years of COVID. So, I think the effect of that was that by the time of my application, I hadn't really had many opportunities to tell people about my work and so on. And it was not a coincidence, I think, that when I applied to work curriculum in the same as many other people. The only places where I got a response from were from places that had somehow, where people had managed to hear about my work or cited it in a paper. Or maybe as somebody from that place had visited Maryland to give a talk, and then I didn't even talk about my work with them. And these are the only places that I got a response from. I got one offer, that's from Perimeter, and a couple of other interview offers, and that was it. And so, yeah, there are only maybe two things that I wanted to say. The first is, yeah, try to make yourself known to people. This obviously helps a lot. You know, there are a lot of people who are very talented, and generally, people will just fall back to the applications from people that they already know something about. This is just a natural tendency. The second thing was that we get the job here, I'm sure, was that I was given an interview, but I'm an Indian in the US, so I don't have a Canadian visa. Luckily, a friend of mine had joined Perimeter the previous year, so I got a tourist visa to Canada to visit him. And this allowed me to come here for the interview. And obviously, being physically present to give an interview makes a big difference, because you can present yourself much better. People have a concrete face that they can point to. The discussions with faculty members just get more rich. So if you're planning to apply to a place where you need a visa, maybe that's something to pay attention to, if you can. Might be a little late. I think that's
Yes, I did a PhD in Japan, and I think I have a bit unusual experience as a postdoc. So I did my PhD in Japan this March, so I started a postdoc from April, but I did my first postdoc in Kyoto, YTP in Japan, from April to June, so it's just a 3 months. And actually, I'm still affiliated to Kyoto, but I basically moved to Perimeter starting second postdoc Perimeter from end of June. But the more or less the advice would be the similar to these guys. So like, well, I think basically I did a postdoc in Kyoto and Perimeter, but I had a previous experience in collaboration with people in Kyoto as well as people in Perimeter before during my PhD. So I think it's really good to have an external collaboration with people who like to be in the institute as a postdoc in the future. And in Kyoto, I did a postdoc, but I did a postdoc as a JSBS fellowship, so I got a fellowship. So I think the details about the fellowship really depend on which fellowship you get. And the fellowship I get is the ones from the kind of Japanese Science Association. So I'm not sure whether my experience about a fellowship applies for various kind of fellowship, like Marie Curie, Newton, Pappalardo, those kind of things. But anyway, yeah, I had this kind of
So can you explain, so you applied for a fellowship?
Yes.
And a postdoc, was the application process like different, or you had to give an interview for fellowship? And if you could recommend more fellowships which they can apply to?
Okay, first of all, the timing for the fellowship, and also, okay, so I have to separate the discussion of my JSBS fellowship to other fellowships I applied. So first of all, there are several fellowships available in the academic jobs online. And for those kind of fellowships, like including MIT fellowships or fellowships available in Perimeter, they are just kind of applications, the procedure is kind of similar. So it's kind of like a postdoc. And I haven't really got any interviews about these fellowships, so I can't tell you about those kind of things. But as for the JSPS fellowship, by the way, JSPS stands for Japan Society of Promotional Sciences. And anyway, so they asked for the JSPS fellowship. I applied last April, last May, and I think it's pretty common for various fellowships, but I wrote a research proposal pretty much in detail, like maybe 5 or 6 pages long. So it's usually longer than the research statement. And yeah, so that makes distinct from the usual postdoc applications. And And I'm not sure about the other fellowships, but as for the JSBS fellowships, you usually get the decision whether you accept or decline earlier than the postdoc decision. So basically, you have some kind of backup if you get a fellowship. And fellowships, I think more research oriented in a sense that so you do your own research based on your research proposal. And as for the postdoc perimeter, they're kind of independent research body. Some institutions, postdocs are just doing a research for their boss and working in a group, working in a big project or something. So it's a bit different from postdoc. If you have a fellowship, you can pursue your own research. That's, I think, a bit different thing. I forgot the question you asked.
No, I think you answered the difference between the application so Luciano, can you, there's so many points and like good tips which you have given in the book before, and I would like to look you to emphasize on the fact that it's very important to have a social media presence. Like, what role does it play in your application?
Yeah, that's right. Not so much maybe social media, but at least have a website. This is related to what the other panelists were saying about how easy it is to find your email in the internet, right? So if you have a website that people can easily, because people Google you, that's the truth, right? So if you have a website with a couple of, images, figures, and what you do, I think that's very, very useful. It doesn't have to be something complicated. Just Google Sites, to give you a concrete example, Google Sites is just easiest way of doing something like that if you don't want to program in HTML or whatever. You just put your name there and put your list of applications, and I think that's very, very useful to make sort of a name for yourself.
You also do mention some red flags, like don't overlook red flags. What do you mean by red flags?
Sometimes this is not from my experience, but friends and colleagues that went through this, like sometimes they apply to a position, where they know that the environment is toxic, or the advisor has money, maybe, but he's not a good advisor, and they apply anyways because it's prestigious, or it's
one of the options that they have, and I think it's something that you have to take seriously. If you talk to 5 people from the group, and everyone is telling you that this place is not good, you should take that into account. That's what I meant to.
So everyone here has mentioned about forms of networking and collaboration, but it largely depends on your supervisor as well, right? So how much your work is aligned with the other, and how much your supervisor is in the community collaborating with others. But can you highlight the importance of this networking and collaboration?
Yes. About social media, I want to say, the
yeah.
Need for the non-stop communication. So, in my experience, supervisor was to distinguish two different people. So, during my PhD, I had a supervisor, of course, but most of my papers and the works during the PhD were with another scientist. So,
I was granted enough freedom to work with different institutions that were not part of the same collaboration, in a sense, were even in competition, or they had been served to a certain degree in competition in the past. And it was the case that my supervisor in that moment was not as active as before, so, and that I did some master thesis project beforehand with another scientist. The PhD was in Hamburg, while these other projects were going on in the Cosmo family in Paris. So in this case, since that the question was about how important is the influence of the supervisor, in order to get the position, and I would add especially your first postdoc position, because then you on top of that. Yeah, for me it was absolutely crucial, but it came from the second collaboration. I'm sure that the name of the supervisor and the fact that I worked on different topics with these different people played a lot of role, and my supervisor was very respected scientist, but it is as very clear that those three offers I got were through the collaborations. I think my experience is a little different with respect to what I heard, for instance, in the previous panel, because even though before you never know, but I had more or less a clear idea where the opportunity would come from. So the bunch of places that I would hope for was more or less well-defined, plus or minus, places that are in close connection to those. Because there were scientists either I collaborated with directly on papers, or they were, for instance, Googles, or the people who I collaborated with.
So everyone has their own sort of experiences, I guess. Nice to share the experiences, like variety of experiences, and think I can have some of those. So, Naren, as an international applicant, do you see some challenges? You did mention something about visa taking into consideration, but other than that, you see that there's something useful you could share as an international applicant? Because I'm sure they would be applying to other institutes outside.
I think the main thing is always to just do your best to make sure that your name is known in some way to people that you're applying to. And this would even be, I know a friend of mine who, for example, had her advisor arrange talks that she could give at the places that she was most interested in applying to. This is one strategy. Finding people at conferences is definitely another thing that you can do. And I think, as somebody else mentioned, I just want to repeat that emailing them after you sent your application, just asking them about the status of your application or mentioning maybe that you have another offer that you are considering. These things. I don't know if I have anything more specific.
And if, all of you, one by one, could share some interview tips which you think were really helpful during your interviews. Because I think almost everyone is done with the application process, and now they're waiting for the interviews.
I don't have something really enlightening to say, but just take the interview seriously. I think the first one I got was from a place for fellowship in New York, and after it finished, I realized it didn't go very well because I didn't prepare it, properly. So it's I think it's a good thing to do. Just sit down and think about possible questions that you think they could ask you. That's one thing, and then questions that you want to ask them to show. Show them that you're interested in this position, for instance, and of course, if you have questions in general, but I think it's a good practice to, and then it depends on
on your social skills and your presentation skills, that you can definitely practice. And, but besides that, in the format of the interview itself, I think it's important to just be prepared ahead of what they could ask you. So I think that that's useful.
Anyone wants to add?
First of all, as for the fellowship background, I had no interview, just a research proposal was an example. And as for the postdocs, I had a couple of job interviews, but as for the postdoc parameter that I am currently here, I had no interview actually. I gave a presentation about research, my research, and that was kind of alternative for the job application, job interview. So sometimes your presentation does really matter. So be prepared to give your presentation and try to motivate your research more and try to attract try to attract many researchers as possible. And also, at the same time, try to focus on some small number of researchers you are interested in collaborating in the future. And as for the interviews, actually, I have really a dumb experience. I don't think you guys are going to make the same mistake, but don't double book your interviews. Well, so it was during the COVID time. So I worked from my home, and I had an appointment of a job interview. And at the same time, I realized I had to deal with some other like a package or something, whatever, some houseworks. So during the job interviews, I asked her to pause the job interview and do some other works, and it was really rude. So don't do the double booking, but maybe just really.
One last question for you before we can ask. So when you were preparing the research statement for the fellowship,
okay.
Because you said it's all research oriented, what kind of proposal did you write? Was it an extension of your PhD work, or you were proposing something different?
So in the research statement for postdoc, you only have a few pages, so like you just briefly describe your research and you briefly just describe what you want to do in the future. But for a research proposal for the fellowship, you have to use your post-research experience to motivate your future research project. And usually, as for the fellowship, you have to put your emphasis on the future research project rather than precisely describing your post-research experience. So use your research experience, use your research results to motivate your further research. And also, you have to show it's not your mere extension of your past research. So you have to show what kind of original insights can be provided from you to the your research community. Yeah.
Okay. You have any questions?
I'm wondering to what you just described. So to what, I mean, I guess you answered already a bit my question, but just to be sure, like to what extent do you think it's important to convince like the interviewing you that you will sort of, you have your own ideas, your own project ideas that you can drive yourself, versus like, or like we join ongoing work and like, and sort of drive that ongoing research work, you know, like more like, yeah, do you join forces with them or bring new project that sort of they maybe like how do you balance this? What's the importance?
Yeah, that's a good question. Ultimately the nice proposal will be you will bring a new insights to the existing research in the institute, interesting. So you should bring the, your Nobel perspective on the research. So like for me, like so like parameter, like okay, so in my case, like in parameter, we have a quantum information group, and there are various kind of research going on, especially like sensor Benny, so like Benny doing some black hole physics and quantum information stuff. But usually he focuses on this black hole dynamics using the like quantum circuits and those kind of things. And for me, I'm from a high energy community, and I did some kind of, I have my experience with the quantum field theory, quantum field theory, or more general quantum field theory, and that's a kind of new, the knowledge I can provide to you. So yeah, it's good to have a research proposal suggesting you can bring some new insights to the
research. Thank you. Add to that, in my only interview other than the perimeter one, but this was for a fellowship. So somebody asked me, oh, look, your work is really technical and specific in this one area of quantum matter, but in our department we do very creative, diverse science. So do you think you'd really be a good fit? And this is an example of this phenomenon where if your work is what I call maybe deep, where you work on one thing for a long time, then people will question why your work isn't broad. And if your work is very broad, or you do a few different things, people will question why it isn't deep. So you should at least prepare to have some answer in mind and understand what the strengths and weaknesses of your work are. And if somebody asks you about your weakness, then you should maybe just harp on your strengths a bit more. So this requires a little bit of analysis.
To what I said, if you have to find a balance between presenting yourself an independent researcher with a strong beliefs in its own ideas and some enthusiasm in those versus present yourself like a very good fit for the group who is going to dig loads of job from the PI, the principal investigator, and help you explore. The first is much more important, just in general. You should be a strong independent researcher. You shouldn't say, I'm a hardworking guy, I work for you, I will do your stuff. This may convince that specific person who kind of wants you in the group and already wants you, more or less. And this, the person by which you used to break the ice and get the interviews and why you are there in the interviews. It was at least one person who was really interested in your profile. And then you have to convince all the others, right? So you have to show that you are a strong independent researcher and also show a face of a convinced person, enthusiastic person, and a person that, you know, you should leave something in their memory, right? Because they analyze many, many people, there are many very good researchers. How can they distinguish you from another one? Should somehow impress, even just from the temperament, I would say that matters something. Of course, I forgot about the examples, like, but you know, you should send yourself in the end. The job in, about this, it's a job in, right? So it's not just, you shouldn't be ready to know all the physics flow by heart. You should ready to be to answer questions beside about your research. Broader applications, also typical for job interview. So you will get questions like why you want to come to this institute, why do you want to live in this city, why this institute, why this group. There are many groups you want to work with and you just want a job. But you should answer about it. And you should answer about where you see yourself in 5 years or things like this. So if you have the occasion in schools, conferences, or in PI, I think there is some sort of this, some activity, like training into soft skills, which sounds like a lot of time. Do this once, just once, at least, to realize that these things exist and you should be prepared. You should just not be like you, muted in front of these questions. I partly want to be in 5 years, but I don't know.
I think it gives me a better idea if you are willing to devote like a few more minutes reading a document where you could write expected questions, general questions, not the field related, and I can share it with the grad students, like questions which you have just mentioned now. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? So that I think would be helpful.
Just can I say one more thing about this question? So your technical abilities will be represented in the papers you published, right? So if there is some PI that wants a postdoc to work in this specific topic, they can read your papers and find out whether so then the two remaining things is one is whether you actually deal with work there. So that's why letter of recommendations are important in the sense to for your advisor to say, okay, yeah, this person actually did this part of the work and it's what's in the paper, it's done by this person. And then the other thing, and I agree 100% with what you guys said, like the thing that you should put on your research statement is actually your own insights and ideas. That's not much of the technical part, which you should be putting in the paper setting.
It's more of a question of where do you see yourself in 5 years? Do you have any tips to answer this question? Since, for example, a typical postdoc position is only 2 to 3 years. So already answering this question, I mean, you don't know what's going to happen afterwards. So how can you just answer this question?
That's your intention, but basically you want to see that. I think a good possible way of answering is that you are passionate in doing your scientific research and you want to be a researcher in your life, and that's a possibility. Of course, not for everybody, but this is something long term of a position, so we want to see your vision beyond that position, right? So that you are there maybe for building up a career in science and so on. Yes?
Can I jump in? So for me, it would be a very long term goal, like contributing something to community as an atomic physicist. I would have answered like creating a cyber infrastructure with covering the entire periodic table or something, like a very ambitious project which shows my interest in the research and also me contributing to the community, that scientific community, which is obviously not doable in 5 years, but it shows your vision. Like you are planning to work on something big, like a project, not just the postdoc, where you finish and then publish results, but you have a long-term vision of doing something bigger in the, like we're building a software or something like that.
Sometimes a slightly different and easier question that you can try to answer when they ask you this question, which is, where do you see the field that you're working in, moving in 5 years, and what are the next important questions in that field which you might want to work on? So I don't think anybody expects you to say, I'm certainly going to be a researcher in 5 years. And they're not asking you to say something personal about yourself. Sometimes they just want to know whether you have a sense of where the field is.
Especially for fellowships, maybe, right, where you have to put your own research in there. So you have to not only convince that you are the person to actually get this fellowship, but also the topic itself. You should sell the topic itself. That's important.
Maybe I could add that when you answer about the project vision and the more long-term project, it's important to study what are the components of the department. Many of them you wouldn't have heard before you get your call to the interview, but you will realize that there are some people that actually only inspire other Google Scholar, they actually do work that are related to community. You didn't meet in conferences or so on, because they are not exactly the same community. But then you should be ready to be there. Because it's
is a plus. Okay. Everybody has reference letters and its own query.
How do you find out who's going to be part of the company?
If not explicitly given me.
Right. Well, in my experience, they were the faculty member of those institutes on that are working physics or even information programming. So for BI, they were the people working on quantum field and strings or quantum field, they were there. Then for King's College, it was the theory group, the physics. So it was not about the high energy physics, but there was something essentially. But set up, maybe 8 faculty. Only one had energy. And in St. Petersburg, it was Mathematical Physics Institute. I knew about one, and they were mostly mathematicians. They are the member of the institute that are in your field more slightly more. Okay, that just depends. I think BI, everybody is more or less theoretical, at least many, many people. But university, right? It is just a group of people that can.
I could try sending an email and find out who's in charge of this search. That's something.
In the previous session, they said that somehow if you could get hold of some known person there or try to find someone who could tell who has previously served such a different committee that might have been functional.
And by the way, you are not going to try to convince the experimentalist. I mean, maybe you are so ambitious. I don't know. Maybe you are so ambitious that you want to convince the people working, but those extra guys that you should hit and convince, they should be at least a little bit linked to you. So those are the guys who matter in the list. And you can find them and they are most probably present. Otherwise, they're better.
Okay, so there
was just another question on that. I was just wondering how you address maybe your application or interviews, like setbacks you've had, or people bring up maybe, like she mentioned, like medical constraints, or if there are things that like they may, I guess, ask you about, how you address those.
Generally, only some after you got an offer, same to buy a product, but that's the.
She seemed to be talking mostly about kind of medical constraints, I guess.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. It's. I would say that I would bring this at the end, you know, on stage. It could be liability sometimes, so it's better to get an offer and then say, okay, you know, if you want me there, I need this. That's my thing.
I don't know, because I have a different view. I don't know about your sharing it prior would be better. In my case, I would think, because they would have a clear picture of what they should expect from me. In my case, I did that. Like I said that if you give me an offer, then I have my PhD student who I want to bring along, because he just joined me and I can't leave him here.
Yeah, maybe you can just personally contact somebody in charge.
But I think it's time, and thank you for your insights. And I request if you could, I just send out a Google Doc and if you can just write down the questions, expected questions, because I'm thinking it could be very useful for them to have those general questions in mind and prepare for that.
Mm-hmm.